Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to my show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm your host, Bianca Murray. Today's guest is an editor who joined Putnam in 2014. She has edited New York Times bestsellers The Silent Wife by A.S.A. Harrison, The House at Tyneford by Natasha Solomons, The Light We Lost by Jill Santopolo, and Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, among others. She is the first editor to have two books selected by the Reese Witherspoon Hello Sunshine Book Club. Keeping this in mind and the phenomenal success her authors have had, I've come to think of her as the bestseller whisperer. It's my enormous pleasure to welcome Tara Singh Carlson. Hi, Tara. Thanks so much for taking the time out to be with us today.
Thank you. Hi, Bianca. I have to start off by saying I don't know how much I've earned the bestseller whisperer title, but I will wear it proudly during this podcast.
Get a crown made and a badge and
right.
In fact, get a sash. If I was you, I'd make everyone call me that. Seriously. So let's talk about Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, because it's just been such an amazing publishing phenomenon. The book was released more than 2 years ago on the 14th of August, 2018. Tell us how long it's been on the bestseller lists and how unusual this is.
So it's been on the bestseller list 104 weeks, which is 2 years exactly, which is insane. And it has actually, of those 104 weeks, been number one for 54 of those weeks. So for more than a year, which is, it's incredible. I actually tried to find out what the record was for the longest amount of time on the bestseller list and the longest amount of time at number one, and was told that the New York Times doesn't actually keep those records. So I don't know, but it is extremely unusual. And I think it has a chance at ending up being the best-selling book of the decade, which just blows my mind. And it's a very unusual trajectory because its first 2 weeks, it wasn't on the list. And then it didn't hit number one until 6 months after it had been published, which is just very unusual. Readers were just coming to it. I was sobbing when we got the news, and so was Delia. It's what you dream about.
It's what every writer dreams about. I read somewhere, but I can't remember where, that most books have got 4 months in which to make a splash, after which they will fade into obscurity. Does that stat sound right to you?
That sounds generous. I feel like I've been told books have 8 weeks, which is deeply depressing. And as an editor, I have to kind of tell myself that that's not true. Otherwise, it would be too depressing to do my job. I mean, but I do kind of think 2 months is the amount of time probably when bookstores are going to start. I don't know the exact timing of when bookstores start to do returns. I don't even know if everybody knows that bookstores can return the books that they've ordered. But I think, you know, once your books aren't on the shelves, it's very hard for readers to find them, even with the growth of digital and online. So discoverability is really a buzzword in publishing. And the discoverability for your book, I think, is highest the closer you are to publication.
Which just shows how unusual Delia's trajectory has been. Could you tell us how you acquired the novel? Because often there's these buzzy novels that everyone's fighting over and there's a bidding war. Is that something that happened with this novel, or was it a more quiet acquisition?
So it was a fast acquisition that I preempted before anybody else really had time to jump on board. So the time in which I read this book was, I think my mental state during that time is also just very telling, because it was, I think, 2 months after I had my first child and I was suffering from pretty severe postpartum anxiety. And I was in kind of a fog, and only really incredible emotional reads were kind of breaking through that fog. And so Delia's book, and there's one other book that I acquired called We Must Be Brave, which also became a New York Times bestseller. Those were the two books that broke through the fog and that I ended up loving. And so I think I just read it, absolutely fell in love with it. I shared it with my team. Our publicity director, marketing director, and editorial director all read the entire book within, I think, a night or two, and also really loved it. So then I called the agent, Russ Galen, and made a preemptive offer. And a preemptive offer means I'm trying to get him to accept the offer and not even tell any of the other editors that it is happening, so that I can kind of sneak it out away from them. And I was very lucky that he, you know, after some negotiations, some back and forth, and I did get to speak to Delia before I even made that offer, to make sure that we were simpatico, and he accepted the offer, and it was just smooth sailing from there.
I was thinking you would not want to be the editor who turned down Where the Crawdads Sing. If it had been like a submission that went out to multiple editors and some of them turned it down and you were the one to pick it up, I think those editors would be banging their heads against the wall for all eternity.
Every editor does have that we all keep track of the ones that we turned down that went on to be huge successes. So I definitely have that list in the back of my own head. But I also tell myself every successful book means that it ended up with the right editor at the right imprint to be published at the right time. Because if I had tried to publish whatever it was I turned down, it wouldn't be the same book. That's what the comfort that I get tell myself in the, you know, the cold nights of winter.
I believe a book and an editor are kind of like soulmates. It has to be the right editor for the right book at the right time. So I definitely agree with you there. There's so much buzz around debut fiction authors, and it's generally around younger people, generally debuts that come out by writers younger than 30 years old. When you looked at this manuscript of Delia's, Delia sold this to you in her late 60s. It came out, I think, when she was 69. So she probably sold it when she was like 67 or 68. Was that something that you looked at? Is it something editors keep in mind? And I mean, there shouldn't be this kind of ageism in any industry, but I'm pretty sure it does exist.
I have heard that, but I think I would consider myself kind of age agnostic when it comes to my read, because I actually often will try not to read the biography of the author before I read the submission, because, you know, a lot of times the agent will highlight all of their accolades, you know, or they got an MFA at the Iowa Writers Workshop, or they studied with X, Y, and Z person, published in X, Y, and Z place. And that can color your emotional reaction to the read, because you want to love it because they had all this. So I often try not to read that before I read the submission so that I can have kind of an unbiased experience of the story. So I think that's what happened with Delia. And then I went and read her biography and I was so fascinated by the experience that she had had. And I saw how clearly that read into, you know, what she wrote and inspired what she ended up writing and Where the Crawdads Sing. And for anyone who doesn't know, it was, she spent more than two decades studying wildlife in Africa and had really devoted her career to that, had written together with her then husband three nonfiction books. So she had a lot of life experience. And in the end, that actually was of interest to our publicity director before we even acquired the book, because there had been press about her previously and we knew that she would have a really interesting story to tell. So in that way, I actually think that Delia's life experience lended itself well to her publication, even if it wasn't something I was initially thinking about when I acquired.
I love hearing that you don't read that up front, because so many authors feel this pressure to build up this huge bio that gets sent out to editors. And when I teach creative writing, time and time again, I come back to this with my students. It's that publishers want a good story well told. And the origin story is great because it helps publicity and marketing, but it isn't necessary in terms of getting somebody to buy your book. If it's a damn good book, somebody's going to want to publish it.
I think that's right. I like to think that's right.
What was the editing process with Delia like? How different was the finished manuscript after you worked on it compared to how it was in the beginning? Did it start off really, really well polished and you just guided her in certain ways, or was there a lot of backwards and forwards?
I mean, it was a gorgeous book to start with. Delia's writing is just so beautiful. That opening scene, that opening writing about, you know, what is marsh versus swamp, all of that language, that was all Delia and that was all there. And I hesitated really to mess with it too much. But we definitely did shaping of the story. I almost always do at least three rounds of edits with an author and then sometimes many more. With Delia, I think it was probably three and then maybe a fourth polish. But one of the things that we changed was in the novel, the character ends up being on trial. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but she ends up being on trial. And there are a number of scenes that happen in the courthouse. And in the original novel, the point in time at which that character ended up on trial was much earlier. And so you were getting a lot of the scenes from her life in flashback. She was sitting on trial in the witness box thinking about what had happened. And it just made everything feel a little bit passive. So one of the bigger edits that we made was changing the point in time at which these two parallel stories, because there's the story of this character's childhood to the present day, and then there's kind of the story of the mystery of that dead body at the beginning. And the point at which those two stories met, we made come later so that you were experiencing both of the stories in real time for a longer period of time. And then I really hated the love interest, like so much that I didn't understand why Kaya would ever be with him. And so I was like, Delia, please make me believe that I would think that Kaya would actually be with this man for any reason at all. So we worked on making him less hateful, even though he still, I think, remains a pretty villainous character. But those were the two big things that I really remember.
I love that you spoke about that backstory and the, you know, how passive backstory is, because this is something that I think beginner writers grapple with the most is that, you know, they will start writing and sometimes in less than 10 pages, we're already dealing with all of this backstory. And it's so much more powerful when we are with the character going through what they're going through, as opposed to seeing it through this filtered lens and knowing it's something that happened in the past that they've already come out on the other side of it.
Yeah, that's a problem that it's not infrequent to see. And it can be hard because it's, in, as a writer, I think it's a shift in perspective. How is your character thinking or experiencing things? When an author can really pull it off, those are the kind of edits that I love to work through because it's so fun to see how it changes the experience of the read.
And as a writer, I've come to really enjoy my edits. In the beginning, I hated rewrites, absolutely loathed them. And now to get an editor looking at my work and giving me that kind of feedback, that's where the magic happens. So
It's a hard relationship, isn't it, between author and editor? There has to be so much trust. That's what I'm constantly trying to tell my authors is, please know that the more line edits and the more redlining that you see, it's even more proof of my love of your book, because that's time that I spent not playing with my kids.
Absolutely. It comes from this place of wanting to make the work better.
Yeah.
It's another thing I say to my students is Get a core group of people who are invested in your work, who are committed to making it better, not turning it into something else. And that's where the magic with an editor comes in, is that as a writer, you're thinking, these are my words. They're fabulous. Why are you taking them out? I spent 3 days on this one paragraph and now you've just cut it. But once you work through the whole process, it comes out so much more polished on the other side. And like you say, it's all about trust. Books that publishers anticipate will do very well tend to get pre-publicity tours where authors get to meet booksellers and librarians and influencers, and they tend to get a higher print run initially. I'm not sure if Delia got a pre-pub tour. I know that the initial print run was about 28,000 copies. Did the book get a lot of buzz prior to publication? Did you in any way anticipate that it would do that well?
I don't think there's any way to anticipate a phenomenon. I feel like that's part of the definition of phenomenon. It couldn't have been foreseen. But I knew how much I loved the book. I knew how much other people had responded to the book. But beyond that, sadly, I think with every single book that I publish, I just sort of like cross all my fingers and toes and say a prayer. I'm like, please find your readers. I think with Delia's, as you said, it was about a 28,000 copy print run. We shipped about, I think, close to there, maybe 20, you know, just below that. Every editor has like different thoughts about what's a good ship number. I thought that was it wasn't huge like you get from some people, but it was nice. It meant that there were books out there. I mean, of course, the huge piece of publicity that then ended up coming 2 weeks after publication was the Reese Book Club pick. But even prior to that, it was nice that all of our publicity ended up landing basically within the first week of on sale. It doesn't always happen that way just because we have no influence over what reviews we can get, when they're going to run them. I mean, really, I have so much admiration for our publicists because that to me is like the hardest, most thankless job, because you want to do the best for your book and you have so little control over what's going to come back. But we were lucky the reviews came in. There was a New York Times book review that came in the crime column, and that all landed within the first week or two. So those first 2 weeks of on sale, you know, they weren't huge numbers, but it did pretty nicely for a debut. And then of course the Reese pick happened, and then the sales started to climb from there.
Did you only find out about Reese 2 weeks after publication? Or was this something that you guys find out about way in advance of you announcing it?
It's not way in advance. That would be so wonderful. But it is such a happy surprise when it happened. So for Where the Crawdads Sing, I think we found out about 2 weeks before publication. I can't actually remember now if it was enough time for us to sticker all the stock that was in the warehouse, or if I think we were only able to add it to future print runs. So I can't remember exactly even if the books that were on the bookshelves, you know, showed that they were a Reese pick or not. But it did, it was at on sale. It was an Indie Next pick, and it had a few of those like Amazon or Apple best of the month kind of things. So there was support elsewhere. It was definitely one that we had been championing, that Putnam had been championing and had been wanting to build. There were a couple of those pre-publication events, like you mentioned, and it's definitely one that Putnam was trying to put its everything behind, even before then the Reese pick came.
Delia's publicist is Katie McKee, who I think is one of the best publicists in the business. I absolutely adore her. She's just so brilliant. Delia is such a lovely person. I was lucky enough to get to meet her once at an event, and we chatted, and she actually read my book, because my book is based in South Africa and she has spent time in South Africa. And I spoke about the canned lion hunting business in South Africa, which she knows a lot about. So we had a very brief chat. And something that strikes me about Delia is how accessible she is to her readers. She replies to them on Instagram. She's incredibly grateful and humble about the success she's had. How important is that for emerging writers to keep in mind? And how important is that for you as an editor, knowing that a writer is going to interact with their readers? Because these days, it's quite essential. In the days of social media, readers want to be able to reach out and chat to their favorite writers.
I think it's very helpful. You know, it's not a deal breaker by any means. And some authors, I think our marketing team always says that if it doesn't come naturally to you, your readers will also know that. I think that it's always important on social media that authenticity is there. And I think if you are being authentic, your readers will see that. And there is a real connection that can then be made. If it's not something that comes naturally to you, I don't think any publishers, or I hope that they're not going to strong arm you into posting like once a week or something, because if your heart is not in it, if you don't like to engage in that way, it's not going to really work. I think it's a nice bonus if your author is talented in that area or is really interested in that area and can engage naturally through those mediums. But I don't think it's a requirement. Sort of like I said, where I don't like to read the bio before I read the story. I'm certainly not looking anybody up on social media or hoping that they have like a social media presence or something. And it's also something that our marketing team and most publishers' marketing teams, I would think, will work with you on and say, let's figure out what does feel natural for you. Or is it a newsletter rather than being on Instagram or Facebook? Also, once you get to the level that Delia is at, there are just more readers who are trying to reach out to you. I don't think it's a make or break. I don't ever want an author to have like a nervous breakdown because they're not doing, they feel like they're not doing the social media right or something. Like that's not going to be the make or break for your book. But it is, if you have a lot of energy and you want to connect with your readers, it is a great venue to be able to do that through. And I will also say, if you do like magically have 100,000 Twitter followers or something, that's definitely helpful. But there's never a one-to-one conversion rate from like you have 100,000 Twitter followers, 100,000 people are going to buy your book.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a 1-month language course. Think about the cost of 1-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Let's talk about the kind of books you have published. So you've published all kinds: thrillers, erotic thrillers, romance, historical fiction, humor. They're all so different from one another. What ties them together? What is it that you are looking for when you pick up a manuscript?
I'm looking for that emotional connection. I often say I'm looking either to be deeply moved or wildly entertained, and nowhere in between. I want one of those feelings. And for me, the thrillers, they can be wildly entertaining, take you completely out of your life. For the more kind of historical fiction or women's fiction, I'm looking for something that's deeply moving or inspiring in some way. I'm a real romantic at heart, and I don't just mean that in sort of love romance. I mean like that idea of the world, that the world is beautiful and that a book should touch your heart and help remind you what is beautiful about humanity. I mean, the world is a shitstorm. You know, the world is a complete and utter shitstorm. And I just want to be reminded that there is integrity and that humans are capable of such deep, like we can touch one another, we can care for one another, we can move one another. And that's what I look for in the reads that I absolutely love. I think that's what I felt in Where the Crawdads Sing, was that there was this deeply human heart to the book and it inspired me in some way. I have actually moved away a bit from publishing thrillers, I think as a result maybe of having children. I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I just couldn't read about like death anymore. I'm starting to come back to it more of the sort of suspense, like domestic suspense, as it's called. But for a while there, I really couldn't do that. But I do also, I love escapist fiction. And I think that comes back to the just wanting to help people, inspire them. I think escape is also a necessary part of the shitstorm world that we're living in.
So I was looking at most of the authors that you've published are women. And then you acquired Richard Roper's How Not to Die Alone, which is now being renamed as Something to Live For. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about that, but definitely that ties into what you've said, because that book has huge heart. It looked at loneliness. It looked at how we connect to each other. And it was a really, really heartwarming read. I loved it. That book, with its title changing, that's quite unusual, isn't it? Why did that happen?
That happened because one of our accounts specifically asked us to change it and said they would take more copies if we changed it. But also, the paperback was due to come out in the middle of the pandemic, and it was called How Not to Die Alone. And one of the biggest heartbreaks of this pandemic is that it has literally forced so many people to die alone and for families not to be able to be there for their loved ones. And so it made a lot of sense to us that having a title that was a bit more inspiring, like Something to Live For, would just hit a better emotional note, taking into consideration the world that we're publishing into. And that's something that you always have to do. I mean, the world is changing so fast right now that sometimes you do have to rethink your title much later than you thought you would, or you have to rethink like how you're talking about the book or the marketing campaign that you're doing, because it's so important to be sensitive to readers and know that you're reaching them where they are.
And I used to think that a title was self-evident and that readers would just get it. And then with my last book that came out, which was called If You Want to Make God Laugh, and that came from the Jewish saying, man plans, God laughs. So I thought it was pretty evident that my readers would know this is a story about people who were planning things that didn't work out, and you know that their life went on these tangents. And so many reviews I've seen have been people saying, I really love this book, but the title doesn't make any sense because this wasn't a funny book at all. And you go, well, you know, it wasn't meant to be a funny book. You know, it was meant to show how our plans make God laugh, because, you know, things are not always going to work out the way they do. So, yeah. But with COVID, I could definitely understand the title change for that book. Have you, as an editor, ever asked an author upfront before you've signed them on to work on revisions, to do rewrites? Because I've been chatting to so many authors as part of this series, and many of them are saying that they didn't sell the novel in the first round of submissions, that the novel went out, they got a whole bunch of feedback from editors. They then worked on the book for another 6 months, revised, resubmitted. And I'm wondering, you know, if that's something you've ever done and then gone on to acquire a book, or if it's a case of, no, this book isn't right for me, and then you're able to walk away from it.
There have been a few cases where I have given feedback. I don't think I've ever actually gone on to acquire them. And it's every editor is constantly learning. They're learning about how they can best do their job. They're learning about what works for them. And I think something that I have learned over the last 10 or 11 years is that once I have an initial impression of something, it is very hard for me to set that aside. And I think that's a part of what allows me to just know pretty definitively if I love something or if I don't. But also as an editor, you're constantly second guessing yourself, or at least I am, because I know that I can make a book better, or like maybe this book would be better. And there are only so many times that you fall head over heels completely in love with something. So, you know, you have to have a vision for what that book could be. But I have learned over time that for myself personally, if I give notes, I am not able to kind of get past that initial, or I haven't yet been able to get past that initial impression. I do also think that, I mean, it is a really big, it's a big commitment when as an editor, you give notes at all. It's a time commitment. You know that you're giving some kind of, even though everybody knows you're not guaranteeing you're going to be able to acquire the book, there's always going to be sort of emotional expectations. And I always try to take into account what the author is going through. I don't want to ever raise hopes that are going to just, I know I can't follow through on. I don't really tend to do that anymore. But I know that a lot of younger editors, sometimes that's the only way that they can end up acquiring, because they need the read to be a certain way before they can get the team to be on board in order to be able to acquire it. I also do always hope that my expertise in the notes that I give, even if I don't end up acquiring it, I hope that it helps the author and the agent, because they'll have, I do think, a better manuscript that they can then go out with.
Great editorial notes, even in rejections, are hugely helpful, because you as the author have probably spent 2-3 years on this book. You can't see the wood for the trees. You're so mired in it, and your agent has read it so many times, et cetera, et cetera. So getting a fresh read and getting useful notes in terms of being able to use them for rewrites, I think is a gift to most authors. And many of them don't see it as such. They just see it as a rejection. And so they don't incorporate those notes quite as effectively. Have you ever worked with an author, and you don't have to give us any names here, that has been super resistant to editorial feedback, who's been super resistant to changes? And how is that something that you're able to navigate?
Yes, and it is very hard to navigate. I mean, again, I think you live and you learn. It tended to happen more earlier in my career, and I think that I probably wasn't as adept at giving the feedback. As I said, the relationship is completely dependent upon trust. And as you said, most of your authors, they've been working on these books for 2-3 years, maybe even longer. And that care deserves a gentle delivery of the edits that you need to make. And that is when I learned that I should always have a phone call with the author before I send my editorial notes, because I think being able to talk it through and for them to hear in my voice the love that I have for their work and the care that I have for them helps to ease the blow of some of the requests a little bit. I also started to have my assistant read through my comments because I do my line edits and my comments in the manuscript. And I started to have my assistant read through the comments to say, are they as diplomatic as they should be? And if they're not, flag them for me so I can reword them a little bit. Those are the things that you learn. And that come with experience is...
That's a really good point. I remember with my first novel, before it went out on submission, we had it looked at editorially in-house with the agency. And the person who did the edit was very skilled. They had a lot of expertise. They had some great points. But there were actual parts that they highlight and they said, oh my God, I'm rolling my eyes right now. And when it came back to me, this is what I saw. And apparently my agent had already been through it and taken out the worst of the comments. Oh. And that's the kind of thing that makes a writer just want to curl up in a ball and give up writing forever. So as the editor, it is a bit of hand-holding, making it better, being a bit of a therapist, and certainly not delivering these throat punches in terms of editorial feedback. So for the writers out there who are dreaming of being the next Delia Owens, because every writer dreams that their novel will be involved in a bidding war, that their novel will hit the New York Times bestseller list, is there any kind of advice that could be practical or useful to them? Because something that I'm discovering, and I don't know if you as editors are discovering this, is that borders or the lines between genres are blurring so much. It used to be that a book was very much one thing or it was very much another thing. And you always had to explain to a publisher what genre your book fell into. And nowadays we're seeing books that are part horror, part thriller, part whatever.
I think it does still sometimes make it harder when a book falls between genres. I guess this is a twofold answer. On the one hand, it's harder because one of the questions we always ask, and I guess this is more of a traditional point of view, is where is it going to be shelved in the bookstore? Is it going to be shelved in the general fiction section? Is it going to be shelved in the mystery section? Sometimes it's a bit more of a question, I think, even on the nonfiction side of things. But with so many more people, at least especially now during the pandemic, buying online, that maybe matters slightly less. But at the same time, you still, as a publisher, you're always asking yourself the question, do I know how to find the audience for this book? And do I know where they are? And if the book falls truly between genres, it can be harder to find them. I think with Where the Crawdads Sing, I have always been surprised when people talk about it as suspense or people talk about it as a mystery, because to me, what I fell in love with was the love story and that kind of coming of age story. But so Where the Crawdads Sing, it really does kind of bridge the genres. And I think, I hope maybe that is creating more of a space for more of these kinds of books. But I remember, I mean, that did make it hard to talk about, made it hard for me to figure out where we were going to put the book. So I think in terms of advice, I think if the writing is feeling easy to you, your readers will sense that. If the writing is coming, if it's really feeling like work in a certain scene or for a certain character, your reader will also feel that way. It will also feel like work for your reader. So I think that doesn't mean don't keep working at like throw away something that's not coming naturally. But I think where it's coming easily, the voices that are coming easily to you, lean into those, because that is going to be more enjoyable for your reader to experience. Like if you think that you're writing a thriller, but the voice is really humorous, maybe it is like women's fiction. You think you're writing a romance, but it's too biting or something, or it's too edgy. Maybe you're writing a different kind of novel. I think just being open to what does come naturally to you, maybe more than having a fixed idea about exactly what it is you're setting out to do. Of course, that is so subjective. Every writer's experience and their approach is so different. In terms of kind of chasing trends, I think that's, it can be hard to do. It depends on what kind of writer you want to be, I guess. There are writers who feel they really want their book to be unique, or they really want it to be seen as sort of more literary. They don't want to be writing into a trend. And I think that's a certain kind of writer. I think there are also writers who want to be writing with higher frequency or specifically to be part of a trend. And I think if that's the case, find a really great story, especially if you're doing historical fiction or something, just find a really great story to tell and then people it with the characters. Sometimes you want to be the person who's creating the new trend, but that's a lot harder to do, I think.
Tara, it was so wonderful getting to chat with you today. Thank you so much for taking the time out and for sharing your experience and your expertise. It's not every day we get to listen to the experiences of the bestseller whisperer. So thank you for that. And here's a sneak preview of next week's episode. While we were talking about sex in writing, I laughed so much when I found out that there is an award called the Literary Review's Bad Sex in Fiction Award. Now, for the listeners who don't know what this is, I just want to give you a bit of a background. So since 1993, the Bad Sex in Fiction Award has honored the year's most outstandingly awful scene of sexual depiction in an otherwise good novel. And this award tends to focus on literary fiction. So drawing attention to the poorly written, redundant, or downright cringeworthy passages of sexual description in modern fiction. The prize is not intended to cover pornographic or expressly erotic literature. In 2019, there were two winners. Apparently, there was a tie. And it's not surprising at all to me that both of these winners were men. And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.